House Committee on Judiciary, Subcommittee on Family Justice, January 30, 1991, 3 p.m., Hearing Room 357. The following items are listed for possible reconsideration and work session: House Bill 2099, public hearing and possible work session on House Bills 2406, 2395, 2411, and 2412.
We have a lot to get through today, so we're going to jump right in. We're looking for Representative Mannix before we can start in on finishing up the work on House Bill 2099. Keeping with our tradition, I've brought a little more colorful history for you today. The diaries of Judge Matthew Deedy. For those in the audience who don't know, we start this committee every day with about 2 minutes of Oregon history for no other reason than that it seems a little bit interesting and worthwhile. Those of you who don't know Judge Deedy, he was a federal district court judge in the latter part of the 1800s in Oregon, and quite a character. He keeps quite a diary, and the introduction to this book says, and this is very worthwhile reading if you've never looked through it. In January 1870, when this diary opens, Deedy was nearing 47 years of age. He was tall for that day, 2 inches above 6 feet, inclined to the portliness which was fashionable among substantial people, with large protuberant eyes and auburn hair and beard still only slightly touched by gray. His movements were deliberate, perhaps to conceal his natural awkwardness. In thought, he was apt to comb his fingers through his beard, and as he stalked majestically down the center aisle of Trinity Church, it was his habit to push his lips slowly in and out, after the manner of a man pondering profundities. His expression was that of a conscious rectitude. He looked nothing at all like a man who would keep this diary. Among the other things that he had to say, his obiter dicta sayings that Judge Deedy was famous for, fond of saying, conduct yourselves in such a manner as to convince the world that you respect your profession and that a man may be an honest gentleman, albeit a lawyer. As a case in point, I cite a trial between two settlers before a jury of their peers in the early days of this country concerning the possession of a piece of land. A distinguished citizen of this state, since a United States senator, who acted as counsel for one of the parties, succeeded in getting a verdict by urging upon the jury that the adverse party, having dug up a dead Indian on the plains for his blanket, had no right to land, which a jury of Oregonians was, of course, bound to respect. And then an entry from the diary having to do with politics and the state legislature. Had a long talk with Bush, from which I learned that B.H., that's Ben Holliday, was going to be a candidate for the Senate and that he and Nesmith were for him. Barnhart regaled me with the story of Esther Campbell having had a child at Sam Smith's house in August 1870 and that Ben Holliday was the father of the child and had it secreted at St. Paul's in Marion County. Said he was going to have Ben Holliday indicted. Left Salem on a train at 3:30 p.m. and reached Portland in good time. Attended the reception given to Mitchell at the courthouse. A crowd was radiant and immense. Harvey Scott's address of welcome was awkwardly delivered, but was full of bright thought and sound philosophy. Mitchell's reply occupied half an hour and was very handsomely delivered, but was little else than words. Attended the Grand Circus in the evening, met the pages there, a gloomy, raw, cold place. Every time I go to a circus, I am disgusted with myself and vow I will never go again. But when a year rolls around and the circus comes with it, the vagabond rises up in me and I want to go again and do. Somehow I thought it was appropriate that political scandal and circuses and the state legislature were all wrapped up together. So we will start with House Bill 2099, and I will start by moving reconsideration of House Bill 2099. The committee will recall that we spent some substantial time on this the other day, that there was a little bit of controversy about whether one of the amendments that we pushed through was in compliance with federal law. Representative Mannix agreed that if there were turned out to be problems, that he would be happy to have the bill brought back for a reconsideration of his amendment, and he has graciously agreed to do that. So we will, do I need a vote on that, Council, on that motion?
No.
Any objections to hearing reconsideration on 2099? Hearing none, we are in work session on House Bill 2099.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mannix.
I believe committee members have the dash two amendments in front of them. I move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2099, which in effect will substitute for the amendments that I had proposed at the last subcommittee meeting. And if I may, I'll explain.
Representative Mannix moves the dash two amendments. Representative Mannix, to your motion.
Thank you. Again, I appreciate the consideration of the chair in allowing us to handle this matter. Some of you may recall our discussion as to constitutional requirements that might exist in regard to parents also consenting to provision of records. And what we found out was that the one situation that exists where there may be a concern has to do with a minor who, in effect, is in jeopardy. And that minor will then have to have counsel. And the court decisions indicate that in a situation where the minor has counsel, we should not be adding on any other layering of consent requirements, that the minor who has the advice of counsel is the person who has the right to waive or demand that certain rights be respected. And what we've done here is added then phraseology, if the student is a minor and is represented by counsel in any juvenile court proceedings with the consent of the student. And what that does is it takes care of the concern, I think, then about the right of students who have counsel to act independent of their parents. And working with the counsel Robinson, I think that takes care of the constitutional concern that was expressed.
Thank you, Representative Mannix. Counsel, we now have basically two provisions in there about the child being a minor. The first, I take it, juvenile court with consent, with the representation of counsel. The second then being in some other civil proceeding where counsel is not involved. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And you're satisfied that this proposal will eliminate any of the problems we ran into with the case law?
I'm satisfied that it will eliminate, to the best of the legislature's ability, the ability of a court to second guess what the legislature is doing. I think that this is a constitutionally sound way of handling it.
Okay. Representative Edmondson.
A question to counsel or Representative Mannix or the chair or whoever can answer it. If this deals with use in a juvenile court proceeding, and I guess that's the limited context these would be used, I can understand when a juvenile would be represented by counsel in such a proceeding, but Part B there, whereas a minor, and that is really the language we had the last time, does that mean that the student has not yet had an opportunity to engage counsel? At what point does Part B occur? Because I can imagine that I want to make sure they have an opportunity to have counsel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edmondson, I think that the answer is more of a pragmatic one, in that if a child is referred to the court on a crime, which under 476.1a would be a criminal offense, and the court decides not to proceed and to do an informal disposition or handle it in some other way so that the right to counsel does not attach, but the child could be within the jurisdiction of the court during the course of the informal disposition or some other type of scenario, then, in fact, I think the second option would kick in. A kid may be on an informal contract for 6 months on what maybe started out as a burglary, got reduced to a criminal trespass, and then they put him on a six-month contract. I also, quite frankly, don't see a situation where the student's behavioral records were going to be an issue in that situation. Because this is limited to behavioral records, the issues on the pragmatic side are going to be remand issues where there's clearly going to be a right to counsel attaching immediately, and I think major felony offenses where placement at McLaren, for example, is an option. So in a way, it's an informal line between serious offenses where behavioral records are more likely going to be used and an informal line. There also is pretty much a right to counsel on all 1A cases. You don't always get them if the case is informally handled, and I think, quite frankly, in those situations, Representative Mannix's point is well taken, in that if it's the parent and the juvenile court counselor and the child, and they're handling this case, as we've heard last week and as we're going to hear, in situations like came up on the drug diversion bill, student behavioral records are not going to be an issue in those cases. Student behavioral records are a very particular part of most student records. And so in that situation, I do not think that there will be an issue.
Okay, so I just take, for interpretive purposes, I don't propose an amendment here. But then to say, when we say is represented by counsel, we really mean has the right to be represented.
Yes.
Yes. And well, I think truthfully, by line six, that's implied.
I just want the record to be clear.
Because of counsel, because of the reference to the ORS Chapter 419?
Correct.
Further
and the additional sentence in terms of becoming an adult, but yes,
right,
because of that specific reference.
Further discussion on Representative Mannix's proposed amendment to House Bill 2099. Representative Bowman.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and it's really a question for Representative Mannix. Had we had already adopted the 2099-1 amendment?
Yes.
Yes.
And if I...
Counsel.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman,
I have...
What is on, just for clarification, in the dash two amendments, 1, 2, and 3, well, everything that's on the dash two amendments has been adopted by the committee with the exception of the additional words on lines 8 and 9. So the other items were adopted by the committee last time on non-LC versions. All we have done is merged them all into one document that has all the two sets of amendments that were previously considered by this committee and the new language which addresses the potential legal problem with the Part B of this subsection. Did you follow me?
Yeah, I'm following you. I'm wondering, actually, and this is probably just oversensitivity to the language that's being introduced into the statute, but I'm wondering if in the federal statute there is any requirement similar to the one that we are going to introduce that pertains to signed parental consent to the transfer of student records being received by the district.
The rest of the language, where are you in the bill?
I'm on page 3, line 1, after sub 3. It's in the dash two amendments on pages or on lines 20 and 21.
That is something that we discussed last time and is very consistent with federal law. The issue that was raised with the issue that with the new language on page 3 in terms of transferring between school districts was that many times parents come in, sign for them, and take them, and so that it made this issue between transfer between districts unworkable for those districts because this required that they be sent, and in many situations the parent comes in and says, I'm leaving, can I have my child's records, I'm going to sign for them right now, takes the records and leaves. That situation was not considered in the last part of the bill. So what this does is it recognizes those situations.
Okay.
Further discussion. Representative Mannix's dash two amendments. Is there objection to the dash two amendments? So ordered. And the chair will entertain a motion.
I move that, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mannix.
I move that the bill as amended be referred to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Mannix moves House Bill 2099 as amended to the full committee due pass recommendation. Further discussion.
Is this the last time we're going to see this bill?
Representative Mason, it is the chair's sincere desire that this is the last time we will see this legislation ever again.
No, this is the second bill we've done this on.
The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bowman?
Aye.
Representative Bell?
Aye.
Representative Edmondson?
Aye.
Representative Mannix?
Aye.
Representative Mason?
Aye.
Representative Parks?
Aye.
Representative Sinceri?
Aye.
Chair Clark?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2099 has passed the full committee due pass recommendation. And who has not been visited by the carrier pigeon here recently? Representative Mason, would you like to carry that bill for us?
Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Mason will carry that bill.
Eagerly.
Eagerly. All right.
Profoundly.
I'm going to ask Representative Peter Courtney to come on up.
Go find him.
He's here.
Oh.
He's here.
He's so quiet.
And John Collins as well. And we will open the public hearing on House Bill 2412,
okay,
which is a little bit different than the agenda. And let me just, I'm sorry. Yeah.
I'll pass it around.
And want to, first of all, welcome Representative Courtney back to the Family Justice Committee. For those in the audience who don't know, Representative Courtney in the past has chaired this subcommittee and done a very good job at it. And Representative Courtney, I will tell you what I told the members on the first day. If I'm able to chair this subcommittee with half of the grace, charm, wit, eloquence, and fairness with which you chaired this committee, I will die a happy man. I will also tell you genuinely that it's nice to have you back, and we're looking forward to hearing from you. Mr. Collins, welcome as well. Representative Mannix.
I think you just got there, at least halfway.
Representative Courtney, we're glad you could come up from the press room and join us, and we'd like you to...
But he brought the camera.
We'd like you to talk to us about the very important work of the task force on which you served and the bills that you're bringing to us today.
I'm not going to. Thank you, Chair Miller, members of the Family Justice Subcommittee.
Clark, Representative Courtney.
Oh, I got you confused with someone else.
Yeah.
Thank you.
He's
Chair
taller.
Clark. I don't know how that happened.
He's taller and smarter.
That's that press room remark that confused me.
Representative Courtney.
Yes, sir.
You tell us the part. He's taller, I'm smarter.
Representative Clark, all I'm going to do is make a brief statement to add an exclamation point, hopefully, to the testimony I gave before the full Judiciary Committee last week, and then ask the district attorney, the outstanding district attorney from Yamhill County, John Collins, to start to go into detail specifically on House Bill 2412, which you have listed as the first bill up today. Is that correct, Chair?
That's correct.
All I'll say is, as you know, that I've been with this task force since last April when we convened it as a member, and I won't go into the grim details of what it did to me emotionally, but I just want to read you from a letter that was received, or actually a testimony received from a woman when we had a public hearing in Salem, and then just touch briefly on, once again, an experience happened to me today. These experiences are happening to me almost moment by moment that I think emphasize the importance of the work you're doing and the incredible gratitude I have for you and the committee for being willing to fast-track this and to give it the visibility it's now getting. I was sexually molested by an uncle and my father, with the sexual abuse possibly starting as young as 1 year of age. I was whipped by my mother when I was 4 years of age, supposedly reportedly for lying about the abuse, yet I was barely able to sit down because the perpetrator had gotten rough with me. I was sexually abused by an older brother when I was 13 years old. I was raped by my mother's boyfriend when I was barely 15 years old, and I was forced by her boyfriend and his brother to try to have sex with a dog. I still cannot talk about this incident, but want to show that these things happen. These instances have had an enormous impact on me. I have not yet had a successful relationship, and I still don't. Trust most people, I have recently had flashbacks and numerous nightmares. I have been suicidal at times in my life, but have managed to overcome that. And I have had problems with self-esteem and still have had problems with guilt about sexual abuse. Yet I want to say that I have worked my way to where I am now, which is further than I had ever dared to dream of. It makes me extremely angry that someone who was able to get away with it, please help me protect those children who have no advocates or perpetrators. This woman today, I know she is working in the Albany area. Also, as I today was preparing in my office, a woman came up who works as a committee administrator for a committee in this building who will go unnamed. And her committee was not meeting this morning, and she came in to say to me she wanted to know if the task force would continue its work. And I said, well, I don't know. I think we'll continue to work through the session. And she told me how important she thought the work was, even though the committee that she's a committee administrator on has nothing to do with these bills, and she could not support these bills from 8 to 5 because of her other jobs. She just thought it was pretty important. Now, I knew at the time I was talking to another one of those adults that I told you about a week ago where you just know that there's more than what meets your eye. And as we went on, I said, well, you know, the shocking thing is you learn that so much of this stuff is done by that babysitter, by that uncle, by that boyfriend, by that father, stepfather. And she says, yeah, like there was a deacon in my church that did it to me. And so again, this horrifying incidents comes, these kinds of stories come to me. People are stopping me all the time now. I think on Friday night, Channel 8 will do a documentary, a 1 hour long, called The Big Boys Don't Cry, in which they go into the what's been done to just the little boys. It has reached a situation in our country and in this state that they believe that 1 out of 4 girls and boys very well may have been exposed to this or been involved in this at some time in their life. And that allows me now to turn to the first bill before your committee and have the district attorney of Yamhill County tell you why we feel it's important that we deal with some of the trial proceedings, because they alone add to the trauma that the child as well as the relatives have already gone through. So with that, Mr. Chair, if I may be allowed, I'd like to ask District Attorney John Collins to speak to the merits of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Courtney. Mr. Collins, before I call you, let me just explain what I want to do to try and be respectful of Representative Courtney's schedule. I'd like both Mr. Collins and Representative Courtney will kind of quickly move into public hearing on each one of the four bills. Then we will come back, move into the bills one by one, and take further testimony from the rest of the audience so that we keep you here can be considerate of your schedule. So welcome, and please tell us about House Bill 2412.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John Collins, District Attorney for Yamhill County. I'm also a past president of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and over the past year it's been my privilege, though I pause over that word because it's been quite an experience being a member of the Governor's Task Force on Sex Offenses Against Children. One of the things that we have heard over and over again from people who testified before our task force as we took it on the road, so to speak, was the trauma that children experience in the courtroom or relating to trial experiences or court experiences. Obviously, as the event itself is a very traumatic experience, and the unfortunate thing we're learning is that the procedures that the child goes through with the police and in the courtrooms can also be traumatic experiences. Probably one of the number one concerns that we heard from children and from the parents of children was the traumatic effect of delay. In the bigger counties, that becomes an even more critical problem where the delay is longer and where multiple cases are set for trial on a given day. It may not be until the morning of trial whether you know for sure whether that case is going to go or not. It's with that problem in mind that we have submitted to you House Bill 2412, which deals with that problem of delay. It essentially would create a statute which requires the trial judge in proceedings in which the child is a witness to expedite those proceedings to minimize the length of time the child is involved in those proceedings. In other words, or just in plain terms, this gives the judge a reason or a requirement, if you will, of giving priority to those cases. There is, of course, a good cause shown provision in it where if either party believes there's a reason why it ought to be continued, the judge can so find. But the important thing is to cause the case to be tried as quickly as possible and reduce the traumatic effect on the children of the innumerable delays that often occur in these cases. The task force, of course, supports this bill, and as does the District Attorneys Association.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Collins. Representative Mannix.
Do you want us to defer questions until these gentlemen have a chance to make a
presentation? Let me ask Representative Courtney and Mr. Collins, would you be able to stay around for the better portion of the afternoon for questions, or should we ask you your questions now?
I can stay.
Representative Courtney?
I can stay.
Right. Okay. Why don't we hold off on questions for right now then so we can get an overview of all four bills, and then we'll come back. All right, thank you. Let's temporarily move out of public hearing on House Bill 2412 and open the public testimony on House Bill 2411. And Representative Courtney.
No.
Mr. Collins.
2411, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, deals with the extension of the statute of limitations. In 1989, this legislature took a significant step forward in this area, as you'll, I think, recall. The statute of limitations for child sexual abuse crimes had been no different than any other crime up until 1989. In 1989, the statute was extended to 6 years in the case of felonies and 4 years in the cases of misdemeanors. In other words, double what it is for other crimes. Crime, tragically, is undoubtedly one of the most underreported crimes that we have on the books. And when it is reported, very often it's not reported until many years later. In one study, for example, 79% of the people that were polled in this regard had never reported the fact that they'd been the victim of sexual abuse. Some other research done by Lucy Berliner of the Harborview Medical Center in Seattle suggests that the average age of disclosure of a sexual abuse crime is 20 years of age. Frequently, I find in my office people that come in that want to report abuse that's occurred years ago,
and it has gone beyond the statute of limitations, even beyond the 6-year statute of limitations that the legislature passed last time. House Bill 2411 would extend the statute of limitations until the child's 23rd birthday or the person's 23rd birthday.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Courtney.
Just to emphasize the point, in the written testimony I put before you about the woman who testified what was done to her, you'll notice I was sexually molested. I was sexually abused. We got a lot of that in testimony. You didn't get actually what was done to their body parts, but, you know, how often it was done and the pain. And the reason is this is not easy for people to talk about. They'll use those kinds of phrases to cover up. That just gives you the magnitude of how it's so hard for people to come forward and even deal with this, even though it's deep within inside them. And that is why we're having this piece of legislation come forward. People do not want to even deal with this. I don't know. I wish I was a psychiatrist. I could tell you why. Although there's something mysterious going on here, and so that's why we felt it was important to allow a little bit more time to allow an individual to come forward and perhaps deal with this.
If I might add a little bit, I've been a prosecutor for just over 15 years, so I've seen an evolution, if you will, of the way we deal with these cases. And I can remember the first cases that I handled where myself and others were asking ourselves the questions, why did you wait 2 years or 3 years to report this? And now we understand that so much better. It's almost like we had the old, it's like a burglary victim that reported it 3 years later. You'd be suspicious of that. And I think to some extent we were even of child abuse victims. Now it's almost the other way around. It's like if it's reported a number of years later, that's almost an indicator that in fact it occurred, because we understand so much better now the dynamics of child sexual abuse and the enormous pressures there are on children at that age not to report it until the years later. Some of them, it's not necessarily a matter of pressure, but some of them just may think that it's normal, and they don't realize until they get into their teenage years or later that having sex with daddy twice a week is not normal. So there's a lot of dynamics that are unique to these cases calling for a unique statute of limitations.
I want to follow up on that. You should not assume all sexual abuse was necessarily painful. By that I mean there was torture to the human body physically, mutilation or knives or all kinds of twisting or horrible things done. Some of it was, I'm going to be careful here because you'd have to hear from the psychiatrist who testified. I'm just trying to explain or unravel some of the mystery of this stuff. It started to become obvious to us as to why some people might not know at the moment it was happening, a child, that this should not be happening. So it was a very complicated type of thing, and I think that's what the district attorney is trying to explain to you, is why there would be some delays in some people's cases.
All right. Thank you. Let me ask you, I'm sure the committee has lots of questions. We'll come back to this bill as well. I'm trying to give us a brief overview of all of the bills so we can see them as part of a larger package. Can we get you to tell us briefly about House Bill 2395?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this bill is similar to the last one in the sense that last legislative session the legislature passed a significant change in the law in this area. House Bill 2395 deals with the hearsay exception identified in the Rules of Evidence as Rule 803.18a.b, which allows the out-of-court statements of a child victim, a victim of sexual abuse, under 10 years of age to be admitted in court contrary to the hearsay rule, or I guess you might say as an additional exception to the hearsay rule. Of course, all of the exceptions to the hearsay rule are rooted on some theoretical or practical reason why those statements made out of court bear some particular reliability, such as statements to a physician where the concept is you don't lie to your doctor that's going to treat you. And likewise, the law requires certain indicia of reliability of the statements of a child made out of court. And those, in fact, are built right into the law that the legislature passed last time. The limitation of the law that we would like this session to address is that it only applies in criminal proceedings or juvenile court proceedings. And by the way, I submitted some written testimony where I said it doesn't apply in juvenile proceedings, and that's wrong. It does apply currently in juvenile proceedings. The intent of this bill is to extend it to other proceedings, and most significantly, as I see it, would be domestic relations proceedings. One of the things that we heard over and over again from parents of abused children while we were on the task force was, why does my child have to testify? I mean, he's told all these people, he's told Dr. So-and-so and Mrs. So-and-so from CSD, and he's told the police officer what has happened. Why does my little boy have to get up there on the stand in this austere courtroom and tell about it, too? This new law does provide some circumstances where the child need not testify at all if the child's otherwise unavailable and there is independent corroboration of the crime. The House Bill 2395 would extend that rule to other proceedings, and it's the task force belief that this would add one more area where the trauma to the child would be reduced.
All right, thank you. And
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, we're going to come back to questions if you've got some. Sure.
You specifically mentioned domestic relations cases.
Yeah.
Reflect upon it and listen to the discussion. I think, I mean, not only would the task force not object, it does sound like a good idea. I, quite frankly, I thought Mr. Representative Mason's point was particularly well taken, and I could even imagine as I was sitting here a situation where you had a domestic relations case, and I often find in my limited experience with those that the litigants are in a hurry to get those cases heard, and it wouldn't be beyond my imagination to foresee a situation where a litigant intentionally scheduled a child they wouldn't otherwise call in order to get priority. So that would certainly turn what this bill intends to do on its head
by
subjecting a child to something that they wouldn't otherwise be subjected to.
Mr. Chairman? Representative Mannix.
It also seems to me you could have a juvenile court proceeding where the victim is under 18 and the perpetrator is under 18 and it involves sex abuse of some nature, and we've just exempted juvenile court proceedings. So perhaps we should shift the focus to the nature of the causes belli or whatever, the basic cause of the action. Is it causes belli?
That's cause of war, I think.
We won't play with Latin on that one.
Good term for domestic. But
yeah. The major cause, the major emphasis of the case, not whether it's a juvenile proceeding or a domestic proceeding. I wouldn't care, except why is the child being called in to testify? What is the subject matter of the testimony? Maybe we could focus it in that direction.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions for Mr. Collins on House Bill 2412? Counsel.
John, I just have a couple of questions more in terms of the intent of the task force in this bill, basically to give us some direction. It has been raised to me, and I'm sure that this was not the intent of this, but I just want to clarify it, that this, in the way that it's written, would apply to a 17-year-old who was cited into court on a traffic offense. And I'm assuming it was not your intent to include that.
Yes, Ms. Robinson, I think you're correct on both counts. It does appear to include that, and that was not intended.
It would also, in that situation, occur to a 17-year-old who was a witness in a traffic case.
It would,
okay.
And that was
and that's
not
your intent. Okay, good. Was there, this committee last session dealt with numerous bills dealing with, part of which the conversation had to do at what age, 18 and under, do you set certain things to happen? The committee went through this on numerous bills last session. Did the task force have a discussion about why they set this at 18 per se? And does the task force have a position on what, depending upon what it is that you want to do, what an appropriate age might be if it were to come down from 18?
To answer your question, I can't recall us discussing that except in terms of the 18 years being the juvenile adult distinction that we apply in a lot of areas in court. My own thought is that it may very well be possible to set it at an age lower than 18. from my knowledge of developmental psychology, again, it's not in my area of expertise, but I believe about 12 is where you begin to see significant changes in the way children interact with things like courts. So certainly to drop it down to 12 would be the lowest, but it seems to me it ought to be something higher than that.
One final question, if I might.
Learned counsel.
Can you describe what the task force rationale was for exempting juvenile court proceedings, where in fact most of these are going to take place in juvenile court, and in fact, I shouldn't sound so much like a trial attorney, and where in fact there are oftentimes significant delays?
I think the problem was we realized that just by definition, virtually every juvenile case would involve a case with witnesses under 18. And so how can you give priority when all of them would fall into that category? Maybe the same concept or what we intended to do could be done with some little different language in juvenile court.
Yeah.
But that was the reason why we exempted juvenile courts.
Perhaps you could look at a lower age in juvenile court, consistent with whatever you do with the age in the non-juvenile court. All right.
Sorry.
Further questions, Mr. Collins? Mr. Collins, we're going to give you a break right now, let you off the hook for a little bit, and ask you to stick around. It is my intention, by the way, to go until perhaps about 5:15 today. I'd like to get through at least the public hearing portions of as many of these bills as we can. We've got some folks who have driven away to talk with us. I don't expect we'll get these bills out today. I think that we're going to probably have to set them over for work session. But it is my intent to try and at least visit each of these bills in some substantial fashion today. So
I
ask you to stick around if you can, and we appreciate your being with us. Mr. Paul Drews, please, Children's Services Division.
Which bill?
I'm sorry, still on House Bill 2412.
2412.
And ask you if you can identify yourself for the record and perhaps tailor your comments as well to some of the other comments that you've heard up here. And we'll just say welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Paul Drews, Acting Assistant Administrator for Child Protective Services for the Children's Services Division. And I'm here to testify on 2412 in support of it. CSD does support this bill. You have written testimony, so I will allow you to see our position by reading that and just briefly comment that it would also be acceptable to Children's Services Division to retailor this bill, as was discussed with Mr. Collins and Representative Courtney, to put some limits on it. I would suggest that you give some consideration to not limiting the expedition of trials in just sexual abuse cases, but other kinds of abuse for at least very young children. That would be my only comment on
physical abuse, for example.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Drews. Questions for Mr. Drews from Children's Services Division? Thank you. We appreciate your support of the bill and look forward to hearing from you on the other bills as well. Mr. Chris Gardner.
Thank you. I'd like to apologize. I don't have any written comments on this bill because I got drafted to comment on it by Dale Penn when I walked in the door about an hour ago. It is the position of the ODA that we strongly support this bill. Mr. Penn indicated to me that they have an alternative draft of a bill that indicates whenever a child under 18 is a victim of a crime, there shall be an expedited hearing. And I would then, with that suggestion in mind, just like to make a few comments. First of all, there has been fairly exhaustive studies done, and one out of the University of North Carolina, which was completed, and I'm not prepared to cite to you right now, but I could provide that site at a, if somebody would request that, did a study of all the relevant factors that involve children as victims of crime coming to court and tried to assess them as to the, in the context of how much trauma that they cause children. It was done by the University of North Carolina Medical School, I believe, and the number one factor that they identified was delay in going to trial. If I may, and just anecdotally, and these comments will be brief, I had a case that I handled in Deschutes County last year. The case was scheduled for trial on December the 24th and involved a 10-year-old male victim of sexual abuse. It was continued on December the 23rd. When I called the family to tell them that now they could enjoy Christmas, the mother, well, let's say she was somewhat less than cynical in her response. And I would suggest to each of you, look back in your own memories. Think what it was like, I'm sure this never happened to any of you, when you were told during the school day that at the end of school, you were going to go visit the principal. Or think what it was like waiting for Christmas to come. And from a child's perspective, time moves ever so slowly. And to wait to come to a trial date in a court that has six trials scheduled on that date, in a court that doesn't inform the district attorney which trial is going until 4 o'clock in the afternoon the day before trial, we have children who are preparing to go to trial 3, 4, 5, sometimes more times before they actually get to walk in the courthouse door. So the need to take some steps in this area is clear to reduce that secondary trauma that children experience. Representative Mason suggested that these are complex issues, which indeed they are. I would suggest as well that when we're dealing with, and of course with the recommendation that we deal only with situations where children are victims, we're then limiting that application in juvenile court and as well limiting that application in circuit court.
Representative Mason, excuse me, no. Mr. Carter.
You probably, I don't know why, maybe my own subconscious psychology is going on, but having been at a lot of scheduling hearings, what we call a Multnomah County call, I think that we're all guilty there. But would you mind if this bill were amended? I'm being facetious.
Sure.
But amended to say the state can't ask for setovers because a police officer is on vacation? How many times have you heard that excuse?
I personally wouldn't mind, but
well, I mean, you probably wouldn't. But
no.
I mean, it's
no,
it's,
I understand.
Yeah. And I it's interesting getting things out to trial. I think we're our own worst enemies sometimes. I mean, I don't know how many excuses Representative Parks can come up with or Representative Clark can come up with, but I mean, we just, you know, and I can appreciate your anecdote, but that setover could just have well been the result of the, you know.
I think one thing that would happen with the passage of a bill like this is that it would put on district attorneys an additional responsibility to make sure we carry our police vacation schedules to court. Now, we're in a much smaller county than Multnomah County, and that could make it easier to do. But I think it becomes incumbent on everybody who touches these cases to make sure when a date's set, it's an appropriate date where everybody can show up in court and the case can be tried. And if there is a dilemma like vacations, we identify that well in advance of the trial date and make sure we get our continuance then so it's only a 10-day or 2-week continuance rather than getting bumped to the end of the trial list 2-3 months away.
Well, I mean, if I might, Mr. Chairman, just follow up on that. I've always been of the opinion that if the case is serious enough for you to issue it as a police officer, it's serious enough for you to show up. Vacations notwithstanding, it's just a little stuck in my craw a few times, but it's just it's absolutely true. You know, but anyway.
Representative Mannix.
It has, by the way, been my experience with police officers who handle these types of cases, child abuse cases, that they're very responsible about showing up, and we don't get the types of problems with vacations we might in cases of lesser importance in the police officer's mind.
Representative Mannix.
Why don't we add on as an alternative that in the case of any continuance, that every effort be made that the court have the authority to order that a videotaped deposition of that child's testimony be taken at the time that was originally scheduled for the trial, and that that testimony shall be perpetuation testimony to be used at the trial. Would that help solve part of the problem? That is, you're faced with that alternative. I'm just throwing it as a thinking piece.
I think the dilemma there is that we step squarely into the can of worms that fall around the Confrontation Clause with...
Well, but if the accused is there...
Right.
...and the attorneys are there...
Right.
...and it could even be a special deposition session in front of some sort of a magistrate. I'm just throwing this out as a thinking piece.
The current videotape statute in Oregon would allow for that as long as there are certain predicate findings which have to do with the potential for trauma to the child if they have to testify in open court. So there would be some need to deal with that statute at the same time, it would strike me, because we'd be in the same area and have conflicting goals.
We're not talking just about a videotape interview here. I'm talking about, in effect, saying, well, the police officer's on vacation, someone else is not available, but what we're going to do, counsel, is tomorrow morning you're going to appear in court, and I'm going to be there as a judge, and you're going to be there, and the child's going to be there, and you are going to conduct your examination and cross-examination of the child. We're going to videotape it. That will be, in effect, the initiation of the trial.
I apologize. I misspoke myself. That statute addresses videotape testimony, not just a videotaped interview. And that's, by the way, and if you want to look at that, is...
What about expanding on it and taking out some of these restrictions, as long as the defendant is there also? Now, I don't want to drag you into a lengthy discussion. I just wanted to raise that as an alternative or as an add-on.
That you can find that videotape statute in House Bill 2395, number 24, I think. Is that right?
Maybe the reason why I think of this is in other areas, in some of my civil practice, when a physician's not going to be available for a trial, we often get an agreement and we just videotape or just take the deposition. And, of course, it's a simplistic approach, but, well.
It does apply, subsection 24, only to children under 10. So I think that's not a bad suggestion, but you're going to have to work it in with that statute.
That's the neat part about being legislators.
Right.
We can play with any of the statutes we want to.
We also, there is a new Supreme Court decision handed down last summer, Maryland versus Craig, that addresses the constitutionality of videotape testimony, which would be relevant to any consideration of that videotape statute.
We will revisit that issue, I'm sure, when we move into work session. Further questions for Mr. Gardner on House Bill 2412, reminding the committee that we've got several other bills and many witnesses to get through.
Would you get me the citation on Maryland versus whoever?
Craig? Maryland
versus
Craig.
Do you have the citation?
I have the citation in my file at my chair. I may even have an extra copy of it there.
I'd appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Gardner.
I'll give it to counsel, and I'll copy it for everybody, because I was going to make the same request.
All right. We're going to move out of public hearing on House Bill 2412, move into public hearing on House Bill 2411, and ask Mr. Joe Spinner from Staten to come up and talk to us. Mr. Spinner, welcome to the Family Justice Subcommittee, and we ask you to give us your name and address and give us your thoughts on House Bill 2411.
I'm Joe Spinner from 15016 Coon Hollow Road, Southeast State in Oregon. And in looking through this bill, I find I'm going to have to do a lot of homework because there are about over 20 sections of Oregon statutes contacted by this bill. So I did bring down what I believe is the beginning of the answer to this. Most of this here is really touching on very fine points. It doesn't get down to the basis of it. I visited the prisoners in Marion County Jail for about 5 years. They came to the conclusion that one of their problems is not one of the people whom I talked to, they were in there for every crime you could think of, rape, murder, theft, burglary whatsoever. They had no sense of ethics whatsoever. They had no concept of morality of what was wrong or right. There are people in there who had raped their own children and such like. And I began to wonder, how can a father and a mother put up with abuse of their own children? And the answer came, I believe, by thinking back to 1957 when a group of people tried to get some restrictions on pornographic literature in Marion County. checking back to Marion County then and reading in newspapers, we never heard of any of this. It'd be interesting for the committee to check back to the 1957 newspapers and see what they are compared to now. Check 1 week. Of course, there was no television then. But why is pornography so deadly? I believe that it has an effect on the genital system of a male similar to adrenaline. It turns them on. And if they do not have a very strong moral, spiritual character, it is going to add up to devastation, like the 60-year-old man who raped a young girl, chopped off her arms, and left her to die. He had no, on television, we see this popularized, glamorized. We see women getting into bed with men. What value do our young people have? So,
Mr. Penn, I'm going to ask you if you could to address your comments to the bill that we're looking at. I notice you've provided us with a copy of the statute that requires that the public schools teach ethics and morality. And curious as to your thoughts on the statute of limitations bill itself.
Well, extending the limitation, I believe, is good, except what is going to be happening in the process in the mind of that person, as mentioned, such as revenge during divorce and such like. There is some necessity for protecting these young people, but why not put a heavier sentence, life imprisonment, for example, on the offender who abuses these children once you catch them? But I'll finish off here because I'm not really well prepared for this, but I believe that we have to go back to our school system and require the teaching of morality and ethics.
Great, thank you. Perhaps
and
if,
we could include going back to our congressman also on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Spinner. All right. Also on House Bill 2411, then, we'll ask Chris Gardner to come back up, if you would, please.
Yeah. Thank you. I think the representative who requested that site isn't here, but I've got it. 2411 extends the statute of limitations. Once again, I come to speak in favor of that. And I'd like to just address a few, first of all, anecdotally, a few situations that I've come in contact with. We had a defendant in Deschutes County, who at the time he committed his crime, there was a 3-year statute of limitations. He marched right into the police officers. He was a student of Oregon law, announced that, yes, he had sexually abused his niece. However, he knew the Oregon statute of limitations had expired, and he didn't have any problem confessing that he'd done that repeatedly. Unfortunately, he'd also done it in Idaho. He was not quite as keen a student of Idaho law. He's currently in the Idaho Penitentiary. Representative Mason raised the issue that we are moving contrary to hundreds of years of jurisprudence tradition in the United States. I would point out to the committee that the state of Kentucky, as well as some other states, has no statute of limitations whatsoever for these crimes, and recently in a fairly celebrated case, I went back and prosecuted a dentist for some 20 or so victims of child sexual abuse dating back many numbers of years. I myself have handled a case, and it occurred like this. We had a granddaughter who alleged that her grandfather came into her bedroom and fondled her while she was sleeping, which woke her up, and she pretended to remain asleep. There was some custody battle going on. We got the case reported to us. At the time, we did a very close examination of the interplay of the custody battle with the allegations, found no reason to disbelieve the child, filed charges. It hit the paper. When the paper was published, I got a phone call about an hour after it hit the newsstands from a woman, and to sum up her telephone conversation, she said, "I've waited 20 years to get even with this SOB. When I was in the first grade, I was his daughter's best friend. He snuck into the bedroom, fondled me while he thought I was sleeping. By the end of our investigation, we had five separate women who, over a period of approximately 25 years, had suffered similar abuse from him." So what I would suggest to the committee, the need for this is, I've had many a child sit in my office, look me right in the eye and say, "You know what? I didn't realize till I saw that movie on TV, till I read that newspaper article, till I had that class at school, that every girl in my class for the last 7 years wasn't going home to the same experience as I was." So there is certainly a function in the nature of child sexual abuse that prevents victims from coming forward immediately. And when we're talking about children being abused, how much responsibility do we want to put on their shoulders? And by giving them the opportunity to mature and leave the criminal justice system available to redress their grievances, really does alleviate the pressure as a young child they may feel. Additionally, we know that perpetrators of child sexual abuse frequently have multiple victims. So we may not be able to get them for a current crime, but we may be able on occasion to go back and get them. So I would suggest that this is a tool that would allow us to, another thing that often happens as we unravel a case, that twine goes deep into history. So it gives us a tool to address remote abuse as well as current abuse to address this really epidemic sort of problem. And I strongly urge support of this bill.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Gardner. I'm going to do something. The committee's going to break for 5 minutes. I'm going to try and get some folks back here because I want the rest of the committee to hear the questions that go on in this bill. It's too important to have several of our folks gone. So we're going to break for 5 minutes. We'll be back and start again at 4:35. Public testimony on House Bill 2411. Mr. Gardner had just finished his comments, and we were getting ready to have some questions. This is the statute of limitations bill. Representative Mannix, I believe you had a question.
Yes, I was going to throw out the notion of why don't we actually take a different approach and say, let's extend the statute of limitations for felony crimes against a person and for misdemeanor crimes against the person across the board. During the break, I also noticed our relating clause here is too narrow to do it, and then say that the statute of limitations does not start to run until the person, if the person is a victim, if the victim is a minor, until the person turns 18. Does that kind of approach have any merit?
Well, I think it would, and it would accomplish the same thing, but without appearing to extend the actual statute of limitations to appear to be 23 years, it would still be 5 and 7. It would be the same for every crime, but the difference would be a victim when they reach the age of majority triggers the running of that. So, and frankly, I think that it has some merit. Children who are severely beaten, for instance, go through almost identical traumas, the betrayal by a trusted adult that the child abuse victim would, and it's likely we'll see the same sort of reluctance to report and avoidance that may not become something they're motivated to do until they get older.
Thank you.
Further questions, Mr. Gardner?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Mannix.
I have a request. I understand Stan Robson is here, and he's also a deputy DA, and I'd like to ask him to comment on the statute. He's not signed up as a witness, but I'd like
That's
to
fine.
Ask if he could come up.
That's fine. Mr. Robinson, you said?
Robson, I believe.
Robson. You've been drafted.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate Representative Mannix's promotion to Assistant DA. I'm actually Chief Criminal Deputy for Benton County Sheriff's Department.
But, oh, well.
Could you give us your full name for the record, please?
I've been with the department just at 20 years, and I was an investigator for 14 of those years, and my specific role was crimes against persons, and more specifically child abuse cases.
And your name, sir, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, Stan Robson.
All right, thank you. Representative Mannix, do you have a question?
I wanted to ask you to comment on this whole concept of, well, gee, what about the problems that we're creating for people with these long-term exposures if we extend the statute of limitations as proposed here? I'd ask you to relate to us briefly some of your experience in dealing with these kinds of cases.
I think it would be a very fair way to deal with these cases, in that we know that offenders, especially the pedophile, does not quit. He's operated over many, many years, and we may not get a particular case reported to us until long into his history, and then even after that case, it's going to be a long time after. A recent case with Mr. DeFort, with the farm home case, he confessed to many of the crimes or victimization that took place prior to the statute of limitations, but would not admit to any of the cases that he was charged with. And we had to do a tremendous amount of work and with very difficult conditions to go ahead with that particular prosecution, and fortunately we're successful. And I've had other cases in the past also with Boy Scout leaders that confessed to 35 years worth of involvement, and being on the board of directors for the Center Against Rape and Domestic Violence in Linton-Benton County. Same thing with victimization that's taken place over many, many years with the same perpetrator. And we need to be able to go beyond what we currently have access to us in the statute of limitations with children. These people don't quit, and they're continuing to go on.
Mr. Robson, let me just ask an outrageous question. Why do we have statutes of limitations at all? Why don't we just, and I don't want to go to the up, just let me flop way over here for a minute and say, why don't we just do away with them all and all crimes? No, I'm serious. I mean, I want to get the dialogue going a little bit from standpoint of what purpose do they serve, value or good do they serve, and what are we giving up in exchange for allowing us to get at some of these offenders? What are we giving up in that process?
In this particular case, I don't think we're giving up anything. Unless I'm answering your question wrongly. I believe statute of limitations should run almost forever in these types of cases, just because of the uniqueness of the sexual exploitation of children and what it encompasses, and what happens to the victimization and the withholding of being able to deal with those issues at all. As to other crimes, I think it's probably more of an area of logistics in dealing with the particular cases is why statute of limitations are put on them. It'd be almost unwieldy to be able to take care of cases that are 15 and 20 years old. But when you're dealing with an individual...
Because of why? Why?
To take care of cases that you may get presented to you after some period of time and be extremely difficult to prepare.
Simply because of the memory of witnesses, I suppose.
That and evidence.
All right, Representative Maddox.